Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, December 8th, 2024. My name is Bill McCann. I'm going to begin with the featured article in the magazine, Nature's Swiss Army Knife, What Can We Learn from Venom? And then hopefully I'll have some time left to squeeze in some Judge John Hodgman. Nature's Swiss Army Knife, What Can We Learn from Venom? A study of Gila monster venom helped start the revolution in weight loss drugs, but scientists think that that's just the beginning. Right next to that title is a picture of a tarantula, I think. This is a story by Kim Tingley. There are two opposite paths to achievement in science. The first is straightforward. Identify a problem and set about solving it. The second is rather unscientific sounding and perhaps more faith-based. Study in obscurity and hope serendipity strikes. In 1980, a young gastroenterologist named Jean-Pierre Rothman wound up taking the latter road through the digestive diseases branch of the National Institutes of Health. His goal there was to gain research experience. While doing so, he chanced to meet the lead chemist of another laboratory, John Paisano, who had a passion for seeking out new and interesting examples of a specific kind of hormone called a peptide in animal venoms. Paisano regularly appealed to local insect and reptile enthusiasts in the classified pages of the Washington Post. In response, they would show up at his office door carrying plastic bags, wriggling with possibility. Paisano offered some venom samples to Rothman for his meandering analyses. Over the following month, Rothman experimented with them to see if they stimulated pancreatic cells harvested from guinea pigs. The venom with the biggest effect by far came from a desert reptile that Rothman had never heard of, the Gila monster. Gila monsters, sluggish, thick-tailed ground dwellers, are native to southern Arizona and northern Mexico. They have blunt noses and bumpy black skin with tan, pink, or orange squiggles. They spend 95% of their lives underground. Like their cousins in the south, Mexican beaded lizards, they are one of the very few lizard species that produce venom, which they excrete from mouth glands into grooves in their serrated teeth. The strength of their jaws is typically enough to subdue their prey, chicks, frogs, worms, and the like. But if threatened and unable to escape or hide, they may bite a predator. Whenever they clamp down, piercing the skin, venom enters the victim's bloodstream. This causes intense pain and can initiate a cascade of other symptoms that in people includes vomiting, dizziness, rapid heart rate, low blood pressure, and, in rare circumstances, death. Rothman experimented with the Gila monster venom for a while, then moved on to other projects. Years passed. He took a faculty position at what was then the State University of New York Health Science Center in Brooklyn and set up his own lab. Soon he found himself collaborating with a group at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in the Bronx. One of the scientists there, an endocrinologist named John Eng, was impressed by Rothman's work with the Gila monster. He was especially intrigued by its glacial metabolism. The lizard can survive on fewer than a handful of meals per year. Eng and Rothman paired up, screened the venom again, and found molecules Rothman had not observed before. They called these molecules exendin 3 and 4. Eng recognized the exendins as a potential diabetes therapy. He had patients with the condition who needed to calibrate their insulin injections carefully to avoid both hyper- and hypoglycemia. Exendin 4, on the other hand, resembled a human hormone called GLP-1, which works as a natural insulin manager in people without diabetes. When we eat, the small intestine releases GLP-1, promoting the pancreas to produce more insulin only when blood sugar levels get too high. The molecule also slows digestion and makes us feel full. Scientists suspected that injections of GLP-1 would be a much easier and safer diabetes treatment than insulin, except for one crucial problem. The hormone lasts only a few minutes in the bloodstream before it breaks down. But the Gila monster analog, Eng and Rothman were surprised to note, lasts for hours. Eng was eager to patent the Exendin molecules. The VA declined to do so. Didn't see any obvious benefits for veterans. Rothman opted out too. Diabetes wasn't his area, and patenting molecules wasn't common practice then. You did science, people read your papers, he told me. What they went on to do with what they learned was their business. Yet Eng persisted. He patented the molecule at his own expense in 1995 and spent vacation time calling pharmaceutical companies, trying to get them to develop it into a drug. Ultimately, he licensed the patent to a startup called Amylin Pharmaceuticals for less than $1 million. In 2002, Eli Lilly and Company agreed to pay up to $325 million to Amylin for its drug, exenatide. Under the brand name Byetta, exenatide was approved by the Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of type 2 diabetes in 2005. Patients who took Byetta and other Exendin and GLP-1-inspired drugs also experienced substantial weight loss, trials revealed, but pharmaceutical companies were slow to realize how useful that side effect would be. Once they did and had improved their formulations, the consequences transformed society. Ozempic and Wegovy, followed by Mounjaro and Zepbound, became blockbuster drugs for treating diabetes and spurring weight loss. What's more, many of them appear to have additional beneficial impacts that researchers are only beginning to understand. Some seem to be protective against kidney and heart disease and may reduce inflammation in the brain that is linked to the development of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. You might say that the Gila monster, this shy subterranean reptile, harbored a blueprint all along for medicines that may be among the most consequential health advances of our time. Medical interest in venom has long centered, reasonably enough, on snake bites. As many as 5.5 million people per year, usually agricultural workers and children in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, are bitten by venomous snakes. Those bites are responsible for more than 100,000 deaths, along with many more amputations, leading the World Health Organization to declare them, quote, a neglected public health issue. But most venomous interactions take place outside our awareness, among invertebrates that we are liable to squish without a second thought. Now that researchers can, with the tiniest venom sample, identify every constituent molecule down to the last amino acid, they're discovering substances of extraordinary complexity. Tarantula venoms, for example, contain more than 100 molecules. In the venoms of some spiders and snails, that number runs into the thousands. Venom is generally considered distinct from poison, whereas poison is passive, a substance like a laundry detergent pod or berries from a black nightshade plant that can be lethal if ingested. Venom must be actively administered by an animal, often via fangs, teeth, or barbs, usually to capture prey or defend against predators. Nature has engineered this capacity surprisingly often. There are at least 1,250 species of venomous catfish alone, each with its own venom formula. Venomous creatures include insects, spiders, corals, mollusks, snakes, lizards, and a few mammals, platypuses, shrews. Many of them, such as marine species, are difficult to observe in their natural habitats, and so we know next to nothing about how and why they use their toxins. But in the venoms of creatures that researchers have been able to examine more closely, two features stand out that hint at their significant medical potential. They are incredibly potent and fast-acting, necessary qualities if they are to aid the survival prospects of the creatures deploying them. They can be produced in advance and stored for long periods at ambient temperatures in the animal's glands. They are composed of hundreds or sometimes thousands of molecules that often serve multiple purposes, making venoms essentially ecological Swiss Army knives, as a 2019 review in the journal Toxins put it. And a majority of those molecules are peptides and proteins honed over millions of years to target other animals in the host's ecosystem, including plenty of creatures whose biology overlaps that of humans. Peptides have long been especially tantalizing for drug discovery. These molecules are composed of short chains of between 2 and 50 amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. They are smaller and simpler than proteins are, yet they are larger and more complex than the molecules, consisting of a single atom or atoms bonded together, that are used in most drugs. Such drug formulations can slip unnoticed through the membranes of cells and influence how they function. Peptides, by contrast, must engage with particular receptors on cell surfaces because these surface receptors differ considerably depending on what role the cells play. Any peptide that manages to interact with them tends to have a highly specific impact. The first peptide used for therapeutic purposes was the hormone insulin, which Canadian researchers extracted from the dog pancreas in 1921. It soon began to be harvested and purified from the pancreases of pigs and cows. Human insulin wasn't synthesized in a lab until 1978. In general, peptides have limitations that make them less than ideal for commercial development. For example, they typically need to be injected into the bloodstream because they are quickly digested if swallowed. And even then, they have a relatively short biological half-life. Since the late 19th century, researchers have known that snake venoms contain amino acids and therefore probably proteins as well. And their profound and varied effect on human cells was easy to see. Cobras, mambas, and other members of the elapid family, snakes whose fangs are always erect, deploy powerful neurotoxins that paralyze the muscles, eyelids first, then skeletal muscles and diaphragm until a victim asphyxiates. This prevents their prey from struggling while they eat it. Vipers, on the other hand, including snakes, rattlesnakes, and adders, have fangs that fold back when not in use. Their venom breaks down blood vessels, causing profuse bleeding, which leads to clots, strokes, and other related damage. When a rattlesnake bites, it's like a shotgun blast, Steve McCassey, a biology professor at the University of Northern Colorado, told me. It knocks out of kilter a lot of different control systems. Whether or not something is damaging or beneficial, however, depends on the dose and the context. In the 1960s, John R. Vane, a British pharmacologist who would go on to unravel the anti-inflammatory effects of aspirin, was studying hypertension when a postdoctoral student from Brazil joined his lab. The student, Sergio Fieria, brought with him peptides from the venom of the Brazilian viper, Bothrops jaracara, which he had shown could dilate blood vessels, allowing more blood to flow through them. Too much of the peptide helped cause the unchecked bleeding characteristic of viper bites, but the lab discovered that the peptide could also block an enzyme known as ACE that causes hypertension. The peptide became the model for the first ACE inhibitor, captopril, which the FDA approved in 1981 to treat high blood pressure. It went on to become a billion-dollar drug. The use of Exendin 4 to develop exenatide, the diabetes drug, was very likely the first occasion when venom was co-opted to serve a metabolic function in people. Even so, it's remained unclear why the lizard would have a metabolic hormone in its venom. In fact, the central mystery of nearly all venoms is their extravagant complexity. The Blue Mountains funnel web spider of southeastern Australia, for example, has 3,000 molecules in its toxic cocktail, one of which happens to be deadly to humans. Are those thousands of other molecules vestiges of the evolutionary process? The spider version of our appendix, say? Or might each one serve a contemporary purpose? Stephen Trim was a molecular biologist at the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer when he realized that his hobby, keeping pet snakes and spiders, could be crucial to his career. Trim's team had been tasked with developing new pain treatments by identifying molecules that could turn off specific nerve cells. Making their project trickier, those molecules would also have to ignore other similar-seeming cells that take care of processes like breathing and heart pumping. Most drugs in use today aren't so discriminating. Instead, they enter all kinds of cells and cause all sorts of outcomes, some of them beneficial, but others unpleasant or even dangerous as side effects. Trim began his research, as he usually did, looking through research publications for any mention of the cells he was trying to turn off. He was in luck. An academic group had indeed found a substance that could engage them, a tarantula's venom. Naturally, Trim wanted to test that venom on his cell cultures. And because tarantula venom contains hundreds of molecules, he hoped to purchase it already sequenced or separated into its component parts. Unfortunately, such a product didn't exist. The problem, as far as he could tell, was that the people who study tarantula venom are biologists, and they generally lack the experience and technology to sequence it efficiently. On the flip side, his pharma colleagues had the tools and know-how to dismantle and reassemble infinitesimal droplets, but they tended to think of venom, if they thought about it at all, as a blunt instrument of pain and death, not a treasure trove of compelling molecular designs. And of course, they had no idea where to get it. Trim did, though, because he and his wife, Carol, a cancer biologist, happened to have several tarantulas in their menagerie at home. The question confronting him was, how? In February 2010, Pfizer downsized its facility in Sandwich, England, where Trim worked. Laid off, severance in hand, he formed a new company less than a month later, Venom Tech. In one of his first acts to set up his business, Trim bought carbon dioxide from an aquarium supply store and on his dining room table began to experiment with anesthetizing spiders. He needed to be sure he could harvest their venom without hurting them. He later found that a tarantula's heart can stop for as long as 10 minutes before it starts beating on its own again. We didn't have that defined knowledge of what is dead, he told me. We often step off the edge of science. When I visited the lab in April, Venom Tech had four employees and rented laboratory space on the mostly vacant Pfizer campus where Trim previously worked. It exported the product Trim wanted to buy years earlier, venoms separated into their constituent molecules. At that point, Trim said, the success of recent diabetes drugs had yet to kickstart a race to exploit venomics, to find more human therapies. Indeed, persuading would-be customers to invest in the venomic future he knew was coming was his main challenge as an entrepreneur. It proved insurmountable. 4 months later, he ran out of money and was forced to liquidate the company. Our view of venom as a weapon turns out to underestimate the fecundity of natural selection. Tawny, crazy ants use their venom as an antidote to the venom of fire ants. Moles and shrews paralyze earthworms and insects so that they stay put in their larder and are fresh when it's time to eat them. Jewel wasps sting cockroaches with a serum that turns them into zombies that willingly accompany the wasps back to their lair to be devoured by their larvae. The venom of bees and many other invertebrates is painful, but deliberately not fatal, presumably so that victims will survive to teach their offspring and other members of their species to avoid the stinger. Assassin bugs make at least two kinds of venom and can choose which to use in a given situation. Occasionally, the redeployment of the molecules found in venom for human needs are nearly as clever. Glenn King, a molecular biology professor in the Division of Chemistry and Drug Discovery at the University of Queensland in Australia, first became interested in toxins in the mid-1990s, a period of mounting concern about the environmental impact of chemical pesticides. Where could we find some natural insecticides that were more eco-friendly? King asked me. In retrospect, the answer was obvious. Spiders. They've been working on it for millions of years. Vestaron Crop Protection, which King founded before later selling his stake, manufactures bioinsecticides. King switched his focus to medical applications when he realized that many venom peptides, especially those of smaller invertebrates, target ion channels. An ion is an atom or molecule with a positive or negative charge. Ion channels function as gates that determine which ions can enter or leave a cell, thereby activating or deactivating that cell by changing its voltage. Ion channels are critical to countless basic functions. They've been implicated in conditions from diabetes to cancer to epilepsy to autoimmune disorders to chronic pain. There are a lot of them in the brain and nervous system where cells signal one another electrically. A peptide of considerable interest to King is found in spider venom. In rodent trials, injecting it as many as 8 hours after a stroke resulted in 60% less neural damage from oxygen deprivation compared with those rodents that didn't get the treatment. Other applications being investigated in other labs include a scorpion peptide that binds precisely to malignant tumors, including those in the brain. This peptide is engineered to be fluorescent so that during surgery to remove a tumor, doctors can see whether they have cut it all out. Eventually, similar molecules may be programmed to kill cancer cells outright without chemotherapy or radiation, says Jim Olson, a professor at the Seattle's Children's Research Institute and the University of Washington, who initiated the project. A peptide from sea anemone venom is in clinical trials as a treatment for some autoimmune diseases, according to Christine Beaton, the immunologist leading investigations at the Baylor College of Medicine. In Brazil, a biochemist and neuroscientist, Maria Helena de Lima, is developing a peptide derived from the venom of a banana spider to treat erectile dysfunction. Ion channels can be tough to manipulate with lab-designed molecules. Finding those molecules in nature, though, at least when it comes to venom, means bridging a crucial gap between what biologists know about how a certain creature uses its venom and what clinicians know would help their patients. This is the gap that Stephen Trim set out to close. Before Venom Tech folded, he has since started another company, Ventera Bio Limited, to develop biopesticides. He would collect all the venomous creatures he could get his hands on and milk them every few weeks. Snakes less often than spiders because snakes yield so much venom. That was, quote, a bit like juicing an orange, he told me. It just pours out. Then he used liquid chromatography to separate out the different chemical components and mass spectrometry to identify them based on the weight and charge of their atoms. When I toured Venom Tech's lab, I was impressed by the equipment. The liquid chromatography machine retailed for more than Trim's first house. But more spectacular was the entire wall filled with translucent plastic boxes containing tarantulas, scorpions, and centipedes. From a bin on the floor came a faint, earthy aroma of locusts that served as their food source. The day I arrived, two clinical pharmacology students, Alfreda Boenting and Rafa Mohammed, were starting a six-week internship in the lab as part of their program at City St. George's, an institute at the University of London. Trim's senior lab technician, Stuart Baker, was showing them how to work with the invertebrates. For the students' first try, Baker selected a Chilean rose tarantula from the shelf as a sommelier might a fine wine. "They're one of the most chilled-out spiders you can get," he announced. He handed Boating the top third of a plastic Coke bottle to scoop the spider up with. Mohammed took video with her phone as Boating gingerly lifted the spider out of its habitat and slid it into a container with a hole for adding carbon dioxide. "How was it?" Mohammed asked. "Scary," Boating replied. One of Venom Tech's customers was Helena Safavi, an associate professor of biochemistry at the University of Utah, who studies the chemical composition of venom made by cone snails, marine mollusks with beautiful patterned shells. Safavi was born in Iran and grew up in Germany, where she learned to scuba dive in a murky lake. When she finally got to see a coral reef, she was captivated, not by the spectrum of colors or the diversity of species, so much as by the sheer density of their interactions with one another. "You have bubbles all over your face," she told me. "You don't understand what's going on around you. You're basically in this soup, both chemically and biologically." There are about 1,000 species of cone snail, and some of them prey on fish and worms and other snails by injecting them with potent neurotoxins. One such toxin is so powerful that it's been known to kill divers who pick the snails up to admire them. The federal government regulates the possession of a few dozen substances, and this type of cone snail venom, like botulinum, is one of them. Utah already had a robust cone snail research program when Safavi arrived a decade ago. In the early 1900s, a professor there, Baldomero Oliveira, had been studying the venoms of two cone snail species to understand how they paralyzed fish when he figured out that their venoms contained peptides that could block a reaction in the human spinal cord that registers pain. One of the peptides eventually became an analgesic, ziconotide, that was approved by the FDA in 2004. Safavi is a rising star in the field of venom therapeutics, Glenn King says. 2015, she published, along with Oliveira and 14 other colleagues, a paper describing the unexpected discovery that although cone snails are notorious for their neurotoxins, two species target fish by hijacking their metabolism instead. Although cone snails are notorious for their neurotoxins, two species target fish by hijacking their metabolism instead. The snails release a venom containing insulin into the water, disabling nearby fish by rendering them essentially hypoglycemic. The fish become uncoordinated and can experience seizures or pass out, just as a person with low blood sugar might. This allows the snail to swallow the fish whole through its rostrum and appendage that looks like a mouth. In a windowless room, Safavi and a postdoctoral fellow, Imeric Rogalski, showed me two aquarium tanks with snails in them. Dragging their shells, they had left ruts on the sandy bottom before disappearing beneath its surface. Only their brightly colored snorkel-like siphons poked out to draw water in over their gills. Rogalski is a biologist who studies the snail's behavior. He's also the lab member charged with extracting their venom, which he does by tricking them into reacting to a vial concealed beneath the fin of a fish. The snails shoot the vial with a hollow, chitinous harpoon, which at other times they keep retracted within their shell, and plunge their toxins through it as if it were a hypodermic needle. Rogalski's task demanded patience. He had to dangle a dead zebrafish in the water and wait for one of them to show interest. "They're snails," he said, "so they take their time." Technology has advanced so far that chemists need barely any venom at all to be able to determine its amino acid sequence and replicate it synthetically. There are even large online databases containing the sequences of hundreds of venom peptides, and researchers can use this information to make discoveries without ever seeing a cone snail. "Some of us are a little bit sad that the technology is getting so good," Safavi told me. "It makes field work less important." Organizing collection trips and arranging the necessary permits can take years. Some locations are too dangerous to visit. Such excursions, though, are still the only way to find snails whose venom is new to science. "We have a whole long list of species we'd love to sequence and cannot get our hands on," she told me. "All the while, climate change is decimating coral reefs around the world. Many snails that Safavi might be able to find today will be extinct before she can reach them. In an ideal world, we would just sequence everything right now," she said, "but I don't see that happening." One morning in Utah, Safavi and I walked into a coffee shop and heard a bang. A sparrow that got indoors had flown into the front window. In a flash, Safavi pulled off her canvas jacket to use it as an impromptu net. She and a member of the kitchen staff eventually shooed the bird out through the back door. I came to think that what venom researchers grasp better than everyone else, but what they have yet to make the rest of us understand, is more fundamental and less lucrative than the possibly unlimited utility of other organisms to humans. They appreciate that we are all sparrows, snakes, spiders, snails, at the most foundational molecular level, the same. Venom researchers are thus burdened, in a sense, with a close-up view not just of our annihilation of the natural world, but of the intricacy and interconnectedness of all the organisms we are snuffing out. Kristin Beaton told me that she had stopped squashing spiders. "We are probably scratching the surface of venoms that are beneficial," she says. "Each time we destroy a little piece of the environment, how many little spiders are in there, or centipedes that might be a little pharma company on their own?" Glenn King notes that 99% of the venomous creatures in the world are invertebrates. They produce such tiny quantities of venom that 20 years ago we had no way to determine its composition. I think in the next decade, people are going to be pulling out these really interesting drugs from bugs we've never heard of, he told me. David Julius, a molecular biologist at the University of California, San Francisco, has used spider venom to activate the cellular receptors for temperature and touch to see what those molecules look like and how they work, research for which he won the 2021 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Julius notes that venom, in addition to being valuable as a reservoir of potential pharmaceuticals, can provide powerful tools for basic research. "It's still a great resource, largely untapped, for molecules that, if they don't become drugs, can tell us about how to design drugs," he said. "But first, To tap that source, somebody somewhere has to capture a Gila monster or a viper or a corn cone snail or a spider and milk it. While I was at Venom Tech, Baker showed Bonteng and Mohammed how to complete that process. The students had used carbon dioxide to put a tarantula to sleep. Bonteng tipped its container upside down, and the spider flopped onto its back. She took off the lid and probed it with forceps. When it didn't flinch, she slid tweezers between its fangs. They moved easily, which meant the spider was inert. Baker demonstrated how to grip its abdomen between its four sets of legs and lift it out of the box. "We pick it up? You pick it up with your hands?" Mohammed asked. "I got to turn, too. We all wore gloves." The spider's heft between my thumb and forefinger was startling at first, like a supple set of car keys. Until that moment, I had not thought much about a spider's insides. Do tarantulas have stomachs, brains, lungs? Yes, yes, yes. Under Baker's direction, I set the spider on a pedestal that held a little test tube. We unfolded its fangs, at rest they're tucked in, aimed at the abdomen, and pointed them down into the tube. Then we positioned tiny electrodes just above them on either side of the spider's chelicerae, its mouth parts. Baker told me to rest my finger on the spider's cephalothorax, what I would have called its head, so that its fangs didn't pop out, and then he zapped it with a jolt of electricity. The spider's legs twitched, and venom trickled out of its fangs and into the tube. After a few more zaps, I lifted it back into its terrarium to recover, more gently than I would have before. Kim Tingley, the author, is a contributing writer for the magazine. Her recent features have included articles about what living in space might do to the human body and the potential health impacts of exposure to forever chemicals. Her work has been recognized with a fellowship at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University and inclusion in the Best American Science and Nature Writing 2017. And now I'll read a Screenland. Is the awkward diversity era of Hollywood behind us? The past decade's clumsiest attempts to cram new faces into old stories now feel like a moment and a genre of their own. This is a story by Kaber Chibber. Hollywood has its eras, often apparent only in retrospect. Think back several years. Do you remember packed theaters giving Black Power salutes at screenings of Black Panther? Do you remember when an all-female version of Ghostbusters was treated as a pioneering development? Do you remember when the writer of a Star Wars film described the Empire as a white supremacist human organization after Donald Trump's 2016 election? Has enough time now passed to say that it was all a bit strange? Looking back, you can see a period when identitarian politics were in cultural ascendancy. You can spot the moments when our media overlords, on their back feet over rage at the crimes of Harvey Weinstein, the paucity of non-white nominees at the Oscars, the aftermath of George Floyd's death, vowed to change their ways and atone for their past. But what was particular to the Hollywood of the 2010s was the way these politics fused with the industry's insatiable demand for sequels, spin-offs, and reboots, giving us a curious and mercenary new invention, the inclusive multi-million dollar blockbuster. The BIPOC buster, if you will. It's the same old thing, but with a bold and visionary new twist. Fewer white guys. Or at least it was. The moment is easier to see now than it has ebbed. Many of the films that produce seem to imagine themselves as barrier-breaking productions, landmarks like In the Heat of the Night. In reality, they've come to feel more like a niche genre of their own, the way spaghetti westerns or blaxploitation films do, unique products of a particular cultural moment that now require context and explanation to understand. They remind me more than anything of 1980s action flicks, a genre whose tropes and ideologies feel almost comically redolent of a specific era. Whether the films are good or so bad they're good. This was the decade of Sylvester Stallone's going back to Vietnam to try to win the war for Reagan's America in Rambo, First Blood, Part 2. The decade of flat-topped martial arts commandos, good cops who don't play by the rules. Gunshots that make cars explode, brawny henchmen machine-gunned by the dozens. But by the time we reached the 1993 meta-action comedy Last Action Hero, an irony-laden genre send-up in which a boy magically gets to become the sidekick to a fictional hero played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, you could hear the death knell of the kinds of films Schwarzenegger and Stallone and Jean-Claude Van Damme had been making for years. Is that what watching Barbie might feel like in 10 years, once perhaps the patriarchy feels like a clearly of-the-moment choice for a big bad? The tropes of this passing era are as familiar and easily spotted as with older periods. There is, for one thing, the showy, self-satisfied gender-swapping, as with that 2016 election year reboot of Ghostbusters. That movie prompted enough openly misogynistic and racist backlash to make it look as if it must be a nobler endeavor, as if any Hollywood executives who got reactionaries frothing at the mouth must be accomplishing something important, even if all they did was tweak the balance of characters in a dusty franchise. Then, there are the paper-thin, diverse characters parachuted into major films, put front and center on every poster, but given curiously little to do as the plot unfolds. Brie Larson's Captain Marvel was set up as the most powerful superhero in the Marvel Universe, but ended up playing no decisive role in its most important films. She was later joined by a black woman and a Muslim woman in the sequel, The Marvels, another in a series of firsts, but still a throwaway film. Many attempts to diversify old intellectual property only emphasized how awkward and unwelcoming these worlds were to the kinds of people they wanted to include. The characters could do nothing to change the old logic of the stories they were dropped into. Other films tried too hard to correct the past, judging their original white male protagonists far more harshly than anyone in the audience did. In the final James Bond film from Daniel Craig, No Time to Die, Bond has been replaced as Agent 007 by a black woman played by Lashana Lynch. Can you remember her name or her drink of choice? He obsesses over girlfriends, dead or alive. He is unable to seduce. A much younger Ana de Armas laughs at the thought. By the end, you're just happy that this poor man, now totally out of time, has been put out of his misery. The old Bond films are distinctly of their era, but feel timeless. What's surprising is how quickly this one, in its desperation to be modern, has come to feel dated. Yet this cultural moment did open doors. Hollywood was right that audiences were hungry for different stories, eager to see more types of people on screen. The industry's failure was not in finding enough creative ways to satisfy that appetite. But just as the ranks of 80s action shoot-em-ups contain the odd Terminator or Die Hard, a cheesy era in movies can produce gems. in a previous age, even perhaps during the Obama years, Get Out might have been a cult horror film. 2017, it instead became a global phenomenon, and Jordan Peele won the autonomy to make audacious films and turn into a rare kind of American auteur. And while Hollywood might have continued its overcorrection by giving Everything Everywhere All at Once 7 Oscars, it's nonetheless fun to have a Best Picture winner that has more in common with The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension than Lawrence of Arabia. The masterful, race-obsessed HBO sequel to The Watchmen graphic novel exists in part because the creator of Lost learned about the 1921 Tulsa massacre for the first time, and streaming television has become excellent at providing light, fun entertainment rooted in a broader range of cultural experiences, from gay rom-coms like Red, White, and Royal Blue to bigger budget adaptations like Interior Chinatown, projects that almost surely wouldn't have happened a generation ago. Hollywood is no less dependent than before on its original lore, its aliens and Star Wars and Mission Impossible recycled over and over to keep us entertained. The industry tried to update these formulas with new faces, but many of its efforts felt dutiful, insincere, too earnest, and self-satisfied. Say what you want about the flaws of Schwarzenegger's or Sergio Leone's oeuvres, but they have survived the changing times because they're fun, something that PC Blockbuster rarely had going for it. It's conceivable that the close of this era will involve Hollywood's backsliding away from any inclusion in films, that Shang-Chi was the last Asian hero, and that we will return to Tom Cruise's flying in to save the day. At least, we no longer have to pretend to like something because it has the right politics, or because the people most vocally against it are Nazis. Of course, cultural moments always look most dated right as we move past them. Who is it to say that films from the diversity era cannot, down the line, return to relevance in unexpected ways? In Dr. Strangelove, from 1964, General Jack D. Ripper starts World War III because he fears the fluoride in drinking water is robbing the nation of its precious bodily fluids, a detail that may, in a few months, have renewed resonance with the nation's Secretary of Health and Human Services. Or consider these words. In America, there's a burglary every 11 seconds, an armed robbery every 65 seconds, a violent crime every 25 seconds, a murder every 24 minutes, and 250 rapes a day. Trump's imminent apocalyptic inauguration speech about American carnage? Actually, those are the opening lines of Cobra, a violent, nasty 1986 film written by and starring Stallone. Hear it now, and you may no longer mutter, "It was a different time." Now, close today with Judge John Hodgman on Self-Stable Parmesan. The judge is a satiric, intelligent man who delivers justice. On shelf-stable parmesan, can an Italian-American use shaky cheese if he's cooking for a toddler? Dean writes, "My sisters give my wife and me grief for using shaky cheese. This is considered heresy in my Italian-American family. But we don't eat enough pasta to justify buying the expensive stuff. And with a 2-year-old son, we don't have the time to labor over every meal the way my sisters do." And the judge writes, "I presume you mean the green can of grated parm that I grew up on. I still have a Proustian fondness for its unique dandruffy tang. You can like what you like, but your economic argument is as shaky as your cheese. Yes, The bottle will always be cheaper than the deep brown butter flavor you get from real Parmigiano Reggiano. But the good stuff is more versatile and lasts a long time. Plus, you're lying. You have a 2-year-old, so I know you're eating pasta all the time. Shave some ribbons of the good cheese onto his elbows and see if he asks for the can back. I'll be shaking cheese dust onto my hat, ready to eat it if I'm wrong. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.